Thank you so much, Sarah. And thank you, everyone, for coming. I see many friends. Can you hear me all right?
No.
All right.
I think it's just an issue of raising it up.
All right. Let's see. Okay. So thank you, everyone. I see many friends in the room and many new faces. So that's the beauty of this conference, that it brings so many people together, and I'm glad to be back. I've been thinking, which is always a good thing to do, about something I wrote 10 years ago, or actually something I said 10 years ago, and it's really frightening how quickly 10 years passes nowadays. It seems time is speeding up. And the occasion was a conference on BDS at Hampshire College in November 2009, and it was one of the first major conferences on the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement in the United States, and it brought together a lot of young people from all over the country. And I've been thinking about this partly because it was 10 years ago, and partly because I've been having a conversation on and off with Phil Weiss of Mondo Weiss about maybe doing an interview or having a conversation about this, because we were both at this conference, and I'm very grateful to Mondo Weiss, who actually transcribed what I said at the time, otherwise it would have been lost to the mists of time. So what I was reflecting on at that time, and partly this exercise was, well, when Phil brought this up, was like, well, it's been almost 10 years, and we should look at how right you know, whether you were right or wrong, looking 10 years ahead. So it was kind of an opportunity for me to see where the movement, where the situation in Palestine has gone in the 10 years since 2009. In 2009, I put forward a proposition that we could look at the history of Palestine as being, since the Nakba, since the ethnic cleansing of Palestine and the establishment of Israel, at that point it had been about 60 years. We just passed 71 years. But at that point I said, well, we could divide it into three 20-year segments. The first 20 years was the establishment of Israel and the Nakba. The second 20 years, from 1967, was the expansion, the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, and the Golan Heights and Egypt's Sinai Peninsula. And those 20 years are what I called the luxury occupation for Israel. All the benefits of military occupation with none of the costs. Israelis were driving around the West Bank like the rulers of the land, establishing settlements. Palestinians were a cheap labor force working in Israel, doing the most menial jobs. And of course there was resistance, but it was relatively a quiescent period for Israel, where they got maximum benefit from the occupation with minimal cost. And then I argued that the third 20-year period, starting in 1987, was 1987, which was the beginning of the first Intifada, was really the beginning of the current period, where that occupation became very costly for Israel. The cost started to become apparent. And so Israel needed another strategy, and that strategy to reduce the costs was the Oslo Accords and the peace process. Basically, dragging Palestinians into an endless so-called peace process, which would never lead to peace, was never intended to lead to peace, let alone justice, and was simply a cover for Israel's continued occupation and exploitation and dispossession of Palestinians. And I argued that that third 20-year period was coming to an end, because in 2009, although Obama had just become president and we were filled with renewed talk, we were filled with renewed hope. I wasn't. I mean, and you know, people who know me know I wasn't, but a lot of people were. Renewed hope about a peace process. But I said in 2009, there is no peace process, it's over. This period is at an end. But we don't know how long the end will take. And now looking back 10 years, I think the end, we're still in that end period. I would have hoped it would be over by now. But Israel and its sponsors have managed to drag this peace process on much longer, until I think just the last couple of weeks, when I think Jared Kushner's meeting in Bahrain really blew the lid off the whole thing, and not even, you know, the stalwart international bureaucrats and peace process industry types can pretend anything is there. It seems to be well and truly over. But what I also talked about at Hampshire College 10 years ago was what was happening in terms of the movement for justice and Israel's response to it. And there were a couple of interesting things. One was, at that time, I think it was in 2010 that, well, first of all, it was in 2005 that Palestinian civil society issued the BDS call, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions call. And it was in 2010 that the Re'ut Institute, an Israeli think tank, aligned with the Israeli intelligence services, issued a report about the so-called delegitimization of Israel. And that report laid out this proposition that the biggest threat to Israel is no longer, you know, armies of tanks like the ones rolling down Pennsylvania Avenue. I'd rather they're rolling down Pennsylvania Avenue than in the streets of Caracas or Tehran or Baghdad. I'd rather they're just scrapped and recycled. But basically, this analysis was that the threat to Israel is no longer conventional armies, but something called delegitimization. And the analogy I gave was to the apartheid regime in South Africa and other white supremacist and colonial regimes that existed in the 20th century. And what I pointed out is that although there was always resistance to the white supremacist regime in South Africa, which grew increasingly fierce and unsuppressible in the latter part of the 20th century, the resistance never succeeded in really changing the balance of physical coercive power in South Africa. The apartheid regime always had a monopoly on power, its army, its police, its helicopters, its intelligence services, always had the upper hand when it came to physical force. That never really changed. What did change is the loss of legitimacy of the regime. Internal, even among whites in South Africa, and external. You have to remember that there was, until the 50s, 60s, even into the 70s and 80s, a tremendous amount of sympathy for the white apartheid regime. Of course, it was always couched in, you know, not overt white supremacism, but, oh, well, you know, what will happen to them? we have to be concerned about if a black majority comes to power, will they respect the human rights of the whites in South Africa? That's the language that was used. In the 50s and 60s, it was more overt white supremacism. But by the 80s, the loss of legitimacy was total. And therefore, physical force alone is no longer enough to sustain the system, because the bloodbaths you would have to perpetrate would be just too, internally speaking, you couldn't pull it off, externally speaking, and so on. And therefore, the conditions were ripe for the apartheid rulers to seek a negotiated way out. Israel and its lobby started to see that they were following a similar path. And that was the core of the 2010 report from the Re'ut Institute. And in 2009, and I cited this in that talk in Hampshire College, the executive director of AIPAC, the Israel lobby group at the time, Howard Kaur, had made a really revealing speech in which he exposed openly this fear of a loss of legitimacy. So he said, the epicenter of this campaign may be in the Middle East, but the campaign doesn't stop there. It echoes in the halls of the United Nations and in the capitals of Europe, but the campaign doesn't stop there. It is voiced without shame and without sanction in meetings of international organizations that claim peace and partnership as their mandate. It is coming right home here to the United States. We already see it on our college campuses, America's elite institutions of higher learning, the places we've entrusted with the education of our children. He goes on and he says, no longer is this campaign confined to the ravings of the political far left or far right, but increasingly it is entering the American mainstream. An ordinary political discourse on our TV and radio talk shows, in the pages of our major newspapers, and in countless blogs, in town hall meetings on campuses and city squares, in Los Angeles, in Fort Lauderdale, in Chicago. So what is it he's afraid of? I mean, this horror, he puts it in these terms. This is a conscious campaign to shift policy, to transform the way Israel is treated by its friends, to a state that deserves not our support but our contempt. These voices are laying the predicate for abandonment. They're making the case for Israel's unworthiness to be allowed what is for any nation the first and foremost fundamental right, the right of self-defense. So they could see the writing on the wall that Israel, that without political legitimacy, Israel would become impossible to defend, and that this legitimacy was slipping away. And therefore what Howard Kaur proposed at the time, and what later became really the Israeli government's strategy openly announced, was to try to win back that legitimacy with a new narrative. And this is the narrative that this is the way Howard Kaur of AIPAC put it. Israel, the only country in the Middle East to host a gay pride parade. The Israel that draws energy from the sun, water from the air. The Israel that takes seriously the admonition to be a light unto the nations. The country that opened its doors to the Vietnamese boat people in the 1970s, Ethiopian Jews in the 1980s and 1990s, I don't know if you saw the images of Ethiopian Jews protesting and shouting, chanting Viva Palestina and Allahu Akbar in recent days because of the extent of racism. But anyway, to refugees from more than 100 countries, people from different cultures and countries that have built new lives in Israel. That was the marketing message. Israel, and what I said in response to that in 2009 was, I called this strategy gay washing at the time. It later came to be known as pink washing. The idea of using Israel's supposed enlightened LGBTQ policies as a shield against human rights criticisms. We've seen gay washing become a main, or pink washing become one of the main strategies Israel uses, as well as greenwashing, falsely portraying Israel as an innovator in environmental and water management and so on. I'm doing my review before I get to the forward part. So in terms of the in terms of what I said 10 years ago, is that I predicted that Israel would continue to lose legitimacy, that this strategy would ultimately fail. And I think it has failed in the sense that Israel hasn't been able to really change the narrative. Jared Kushner hasn't been able to change the narrative and to make the world accept that, oh, it's these ungrateful Palestinians who just don't want $50 billion and that's why they're refusing to show up in Bahrain. The world isn't buying it. But at the same time, I warned that there is a tremendous struggle to be waged, which is why the work that we're doing in this movement is so important, and a just outcome is not inevitable. There are many people who think Gaza 2009, that was the operation cast lead. There are many people who think Gaza 2009 was just a foretaste of what's to come, and that the Israelis will go for broke and they will try to do more, try to do once again what they have failed to do for so long, which is to cow and terrorize the Palestinians and other Arab peoples into submission. And sadly, that was true. We saw in 2014 an even bigger massacre in Gaza, and it's now 2019. Next year, 2020, is the year the UN has declared Gaza will be unlivable because of the brutal Israeli blockade. But if you look at the reality in Gaza, it's already unlivable. It's already unlivable for 2 million people there. So I think if I were to grade myself, I got a lot of things right. I would say that I was maybe too hopeful or too optimistic that we would be able to shift the global discourse and balance of power faster than we have been able to. But things have continued moving in the direction that I hoped they would. So Israel continues to lose that legitimacy. Its disguise as a wonderful liberal democracy is falling away. Its brutality is being exposed to more and more people, especially younger generations. We see in this country now the political discourse is shifting. It's no longer advantageous for Democratic presidential candidates to boast about how much they love Israel. That's not how you win a primary now. And that's because of the grassroots work that has been done. The grassroots in this country, the progressive, the left grassroots, have been pushing mainstream politics on Palestine. And this is despite campaigns costing tens, hundreds of millions of dollars to shore up support for Israel. So I think on all those things, things are still moving where we want them to. There's still a tremendous struggle to be waged. And we still need to get more people involved because the balance of power is still stacked against us. But so when I did read back at read back my words, I noticed that I got one thing wrong, or one major thing. I don't know if I got it wrong, but I certainly didn't see it coming. And I think that's a major challenge for us when we think about Palestine as a global struggle for justice. I believed, and to an extent I still believe, that the fundamental democratic, anti-racist values that I believe in as something that were established, and there was no going back on that, that the world had accepted that human equality, human dignity for everyone, that these were fundamentals, and there would be no going back to racial doctrines of superiority, of systems of apartheid. And what I didn't see coming, and I think many of us didn't see coming, was the resurgence of, let's call it what it is, Nazism. That we see a resurgence of Nazism in the world. And it's not just in the United States, where white supremacists come out with, you know, an open pride that they haven't been able to have for decades, but it's all across Europe. It's across Europe as well, where neo-Nazi parties have been resurgent in Germany, Alternative for Deutschland. I don't use the euphemisms of the mainstream media, which say, oh, far right, or, you know, whatever. They're Nazis. They are Nazis. Many of them were Nazis. The rhetoric they use now against immigrants, against people of Turkish descent, against Muslims, is Nazi rhetoric that was used against Jews. That's what it is. So we shouldn't be shy about it. In Austria as well, a party founded by neo-Nazis is part of the government, or was part of the government until it collapsed recently. And in Hungary, we see across Hungary and Europe, countries like Poland as well, in the Baltics, we see Holocaust revisionist parties that are taking power. In India, we see the resurgence of, or the rise of Hindu nationalism, which is pretty much mirrors or models Zionism. That's a longer discussion, but in shorthand, they're pretty analogous ideologies. And I didn't see that coming, or at least I didn't think that this could be as big a threat. And it is a real threat, along with the heating of the planet. I would say that this global right-wing Nazi surge is the greatest threat to people all over the place, including in this country. What is paradoxical, but not so surprising, is the role Israel plays in this. And that's what I want to talk about. Because, remember, the marketing of Israel and Zionism is that Israel is the savior or the hope or the life raft of Jews persecuted by fascists. The Holocaust happened, but Israel ensures it can happen never again. That's the story that Israel tells to justify its existence. It's the story Israel told to generations of American Jews as well, that if the Nazis come back, you'll have a safe place to go. Well, here we are in 2019, and the Nazis are back. And the Nazis are carrying out massacres in Norway in 2011 against a Labour Party youth camp on the basis that they were too pro-immigrant and pro-Muslim. Anders Breivik carried out a massacre of dozens of young people. In Christchurch, a Nazi massacred 50 people praying in a mosque. In Quebec, a Nazi massacred 6 people and injured many more. And in Pittsburgh, at the synagogue, a Nazi massacred 11 people. And again, in Poway, California, a few months ago, 6 months after the Pittsburgh massacre. And what happened? What happened? We saw Israel and its lobby go to work to deflect the blame from the white supremacists, to deflect the blame from the Nazis, and to cast it on the left and the Palestine Solidarity Movement. The Zionist Organization of America, following the killings at the Chabad Center in California, the Zionist Organization of America issued a statement that failed to mention the perpetrator, failed to mention his avowed white supremacist ideology, but blamed Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib and Students for Justice in Palestine. Melissa Weiss, the national campus director of the Simon Wiesenthal Center, also failed to mention who was actually responsible for that massacre and what their ideology was, but blamed the University of North Carolina for failing to cancel an academic conference on Gaza, as creating, as helping to create the atmosphere in which people shoot up synagogues. Mark Dubowitz, the president of the Foundation for Defensive Democracies, the pro-Israel neocon group, blamed Congresswoman Ilhan Omar. And it goes on. These were examples. But the fundamental story, Senator Ted Cruz blamed the anti-Semitic left, quote, the anti-Semitic left. But the key point here is that these attempts to shift the blame from Nazis towards Students for Justice in Palestine and the BDS movement and the only 2 Muslim women in Congress follow a narrative that was set very much from above, and particularly from Israel's leadership. Benjamin Netanyahu condemned the shooting in Poway, took his time, by the way, without any reference to white supremacism whatsoever. Same with Donald Trump. He tweeted out thoughts and prayers. No mention at all of who did it. Really, it was summed up well by the Israeli journalist Ido Conrad when he wrote, "The Jewish American right decided long ago to ignore Trump's white nationalism and to look the other way when it came to his anti-Semitic dog whistles. Why? Because it decided that Trump's pro-Israel, anti-Muslim positions were more important than the very safety of our people." I'd written previously about the what I called the Zionist white supremacist alliance in the White House that took shape before and after the 2016 election. In 2017, the Zionist Organization of America hosted at its annual gala the former Trump advisor Sebastian Gorka, who is a member. The Forward did some brilliant reporting exposing how Gorka was an avowed sworn member of a Hungarian organization called the Vitezi Rend, which had previously been controlled by the Nazis during World War II. And this was the guest of honor at the Zionist Organization of America gala. But this is very visible in Israel's embrace of such anti-Semitic leaders as Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban, an open admirer of Miklos Horthy, the Nazi wartime collaborator who sent 500,000 Hungarian Jews to their deaths in Hitler's camps. And we see this Nazi right-wing Israeli alliance manifested in other ways, for example, in Israel's arming of the openly neo-Nazi Azov battalion in the Ukraine. What explains this alliance and this affinity? One thing I won't go into now, but is to point out that it goes back to the early days of the Zionist movement, or let's say to the 1930s, and Herzl himself had written that, Theodor Herzl, the founder of Zionism, that the anti-Semites will become our best friends. Because the agenda is the same. It's the removal of Jews from Europe, or in this case nowadays, the removal of Jews from North America and every other country. And if they can be gathered in one place, that's great. That's, let's say, an alliance of convenience. But now it has developed to really an ideological affinity, because Israel is the archetypal ethno-state for a lot of ultra-nationalists and Nazis. For example, Richard Spencer, the American Nazi, who says very clearly, he's coined a term, he says, what I want for Europeans in North America is an ethno-state. Really, the term he uses is white Zionism. What I want for whites in America is what Israel wants for Jews in Israel. And we see other ultra-nationalists and racists in Europe saying, well, what's wrong with us just being like Israel, like the Jews? They want a state to preserve their culture and to protect themselves, and we want that too. So there is an ideological affinity. And finally, there is a sort of a political convenience, which is that Israel uses its self-description as a Jewish state. I don't consider Israel a Jewish state, and vast numbers of Jews don't consider Israel to be a Jewish state, any more than I would consider Saudi Arabia or ISIS to be an Islamic state or a Muslim state. And yes, I'm making that comparison, so anyone who wants to quote me can. Because I remember once Jeremy Corbyn was accused of comparing Israel to ISIS, and they're like, no, he didn't do that. No, I'm doing that. So, Israel uses its self-description as a Jewish state as really a laundry service for all sorts of racists and neo-Nazis and white supremacists. So now, if you are, say, the leader of Alternative for Deutschland, and people are saying, well, you're a neo-Nazi party, or your party is full of Nazis, you say, well, what do you mean I'm a neo-Nazi? I visited Israel, and I support Israel. If you're Viktor Orban, you say, well, what do you mean I'm an anti-Semite? My best friend and supporter is Benjamin Netanyahu. And in fact, there was that very notorious case during the Hungarian elections 2 years ago, when Orban was running grossly anti-Semitic poster campaign against George Soros, the Hungarian-born Holocaust survivor and billionaire philanthropist. There are lots of reasons to politically disagree with George Soros, but the fact that he's Jewish is not one of them. Let's just be clear about that. But this campaign was all based on these anti-Semitic tropes of, you know, the international Jew who wants to control our country by spending money here on things like universities and human rights groups, and you know, is forcing us to take Muslims and migrants and refugees. This was such a blatantly anti-Semitic campaign that the Israeli foreign ministry condemned it. What happened next? Benjamin Netanyahu was furious and ordered the foreign ministry to retract its statement. Well, that just gives you an idea of the kind of alliances that take shape. So the bottom line now is that when Jews are being attacked here in the United States or in Europe or anywhere in the world, Israel is not defending them. Israel is defending their killers and those who inspire them. When Muslims are being attacked, whether it's by the government or whether it's by government-inspired terrorists like the Christchurch killer, Israel and its lobby groups are not speaking out against Islamophobia. On the contrary, they've been stoking it because they see a division of the world along religious and civilizational, so-called civilizational lines, to be an asset to Israel, because they want to market Israel as being on the side of the so-called West, on the side of what they call Judeo-Christian values. Stoking hatred of Muslims has been good for Israel and pro-Israel groups because it helps to shore up support amongst Christian Zionists, the most reactionary and right-wing and fanatical segments of the US population, the ones who are now passing laws in dozens of states to make abortion unavailable. In fact, when you look, really this is going into too much detail, but when you look at the legal advisors who have been behind, who are working for Trump and who have been behind some of the anti-BDS, anti-Palestinian legislative campaigns in this country, it's the same people who in the 1990s were working for the religious right to push anti-women, anti-abortion, anti-reproductive rights laws. It's the same people, the same agenda. So this is the point we've come to, that Israel today, I'm not saying Israel is certainly not the cause of the global right-wing reactionary moment we're in. But Israel plays a central role in it, both in stoking it and providing ideological justification and fuel for it. And so my argument today is that defeating Nazism, fighting fascism, that's one of the talks, or that's a book?
That's a book.
Well,
yeah.
It looks like a book I have to go pick up at the book room. Fighting fascism today, if you're committed to fighting fascism, there's no way around the struggle for justice in Palestine. Mm-hmm. I would argue... I would argue that as Israel has become central to providing ideological support for forms of oppression that go far beyond Palestine, so the liberation of Palestine will reverberate far beyond the borders of Palestine as well. And so really, that's my message today. That's the conclusion I reached reviewing my thoughts from 10 years ago, is that we have made tremendous strides in 10 years. We have moved the discourse. Israel is on the defensive ideologically, but rather than fight on the grounds of liberalism, and I mean that in the best sense of the word, mm-hmm. not in the Hillary Clinton sense of the word, but rather than fight on the grounds of liberalism, anti-racism, universal rights, territory on which Israel can't win, they have opened a new front, and it's a Nazi front against us. And we have no choice but to fight it, and we have no choice but to win. And see you in 10 years.